Good afternoon. So last time we talked about deadlock. We talked about what deadlock was. It was this idea of circular waiting where no one would ever make progress because everyone was waiting for someone else to give up a resource who was eventually waiting for the first guy to give up a resource. And we mentioned this with locks, which is probably the most common case in practice, but we also showed that it can occur with other resources like pipe buffers and memory and so on. We talked about some strategies for preventing deadlock, and the key, most important strategy for locks especially is acquire the resources in a consistent order. If we have a consistent order, if we always get A first, then B, then C, then we know that we can't create a cycle. Therefore, we can't have that circular dependency of waiting. And it doesn't matter what that consistent order is, you just have to choose one. We mentioned some other strategies. So you could abort and retry. So if you never wait for a lock because you give up and stop everything, then you're not going to have deadlock. If you never wait for a lock because you have some way of stealing it from someone else who has it, then you're not going to have deadlock. Both of these other strategies, you might have some other problems, but they aren't deadlock. There's something else. We also talked about detecting deadlock, that you can create the directed graph of who's waiting for who and who's waiting on what, who's waiting on who, and you can search that graph for cycles. We mentioned, but did not show the details of, there's an alternate algorithm when you have resources with variable quantity where knowing there's a cycle in that graph isn't enough, because like if we're both waiting for some memory, and there's enough memory for both of us, that's fine. If there's not, it's not fine. So we need something other than cycles to figure if that case is OK or not. Okay. Then we started talking about alternatives to threats, which is where I'll pick up today. So any questions about deadlock from last time? So we started talking about alternative threats, started talking about event loops. And the idea of event loops is that, well, if all we need to do is handle input or an output from multiple places, then we don't actually need multiple cores. We just need some way of asking the operating system to read or write multiple things at once. And the operating system can take care of that because it just knows when it gets an interrupt to say, you can write to this or you can read from this. So it doesn't need to do anything multi-threaded to handle that. And the idea would be we register to get what we'll call events when something is ready for reading or writing. Like in a web server, we have a bunch of web browsers we're giving web pages to. We'll just register events to read input from them about what web page they want for a whole bunch of web browsers at once. And we'll have some way of getting the next event, whatever that is, whichever browser that's for. But a disadvantage of this technique is that we have to reorganize our code a bunch. Since we're just getting this next event, we have to do something where we like look up, okay, that event's for this particular connection, this particular web browser. Now I need to look up my information for that versus all the other web browsers I'm dealing with, rather than just having them be local variables like it would if we had a thread for each one. And we also need to make sure that our function for handling the operations, whereas before we write it in a way where we'd say read something, then process that thing, then send the response, now we need to sort of write each of these as separate operations up to a read, so we end up having to track this extra state where we need to figure out, oh, do I have a full command yet? If so, I need to switch from to a completely different function now, which now has my code for writing the response. Like I can't just do it right away. I need to have that a separate function for writing when something is ready to write. And my function for reading, I can't just have a loop to read anymore like I did here. Here I have this loop reading until I get the full command. Can't do that anymore because in my event-based code because I need to read what's there and then get the next event, which might be for something else, because I don't want to just wait for the whole command to come in and not help any other browsers. If one browser sends me half of their file name, I need to store that half of the file name and move on. And so reorganizing the code like this means that event-based processing, is some people find this hard to reason about. But the advantage is we've got rid of threads. We don't need threads. We don't have to worry about not locking because we're only doing one thing at a time. We don't have to worry about deadlock. So in some senses, it's easier. And it turns out, I'm giving you an example of web servers. So the highest performance web servers, which just serve like static pages, are written in this fashion. Sometimes with multiple event loops and different threads, but the main idea is based on this type of pattern. Okay, so questions about event-based programming? Okay. So showed you the general pattern, and as I briefly mentioned last time, POSIX provides the get next event type of functionality you need through these select and pull functions. And basically, these functions take a list of file descriptors you want to read or write, and they tell you which ones can you read or write without waiting. And that's enough to implement that get next event function. And there are often lots of non-POSIX, more OS-specific alternatives that provide improvements on this POSIX interface for every single OS you can think of. Okay, so that's one alternative to threads. And there's another very common alternative to threads known as message passing. So with message passing, the idea is instead of sharing variables and locks and so on between threads, we're going to have a way of sending messages between threads. And that's how we're going to communicate. No shared memory, no common array that both all the threads have a pointer to. We're just going to send explicit messages. And this is a very common approach. So one reason it's common is on really big machines, so-called supercomputers, are really just a lot of separate machines together. They don't actually have shared memory between the machines, typically. So ultimately, this is what needs to happen on that machine to communicate between different threads. Or if you want to build a big machine from your cluster of machines, this is what you'll need to do anyways. So you might use this programming model if you anticipate going up to that scale. And you can still use it even if you're just working on one machine. It still works, and you can implement it pretty efficiently. And the other thing is that, like with the event loop-based fashion, it's arguably easier to program because now I don't need to worry about locking or synchronization because that's all handled through how I send messages. So it's much clearer when threads are talking to each other and when I can have race conditions and so on. So there are a bunch of libraries for message passing. Probably the most well-known is something called MPI. We're not going to learn MPI, but I'm giving sort of a simplified idea of what this might look like. And I'm saying we have two functions. We have a send function, where you give it the ID, a number for the thread you're talking to, and the data. And you have a receive function, where you give the number of the thread you expect to receive data from, and you get the data through a pointer. And this is sort of a minimal API. You can imagine there's extensions to this. And the idea with this version is that these are synchronous functions, meaning that when you call send, it waits until someone receives. When you call receive, it waits until you get the data. And you can implement lots of patterns this way. So here's an implementation of where thread 0 figures out all the work all the other threads need to do, sends it to them, and then collects all the results. Whereas if we were doing this with monitors, we'd have some shared locations where they store their results and condition variables or something to signal back. Here we just use these message sending, and the worker threads receive the work and then compute the result and send it back. So questions on this model? So this model is actually very useful for lots of problems, and I'll show you how we could do it for the life assignment. So let's say we're doing life, but with different, with message passing. And so I've marked this, we have a grid. I've divided it up between what I call processes, because remember, with message passing, we're only sharing data by sending messages, so we don't actually share memory. So it's like we can just have them as separate processes, no shared memory. And we just divide up the grid like we do, like you probably did, something like that. Here I've just done it, you know, divided up into pieces by rows. I'm looking at the bottom three-fourths. Okay. And we'll just say that we'll have each process store the part of the grid in blue. So we don't have shared memory, they'll just only store their part they care about. But to compute the results for that part of the grid, they actually need a little more than that. So process three, for example, to compute its results, it needs the boundary around it. So remember, in our life code, like we look at an x and y, and we look at everything plus or minus one of that. So that means at the top of this region and the bottom of this region, we need to go into some stuff that process two computed and some stuff that process four computed. So what we can do is we can have process two and process four send messages to process three every iteration with the value of just that row of cells. And because we only have to send this little amount of data, this is why message passing is often very efficient. That even though it seems like we're doing a lot more copying, well, we aren't actually doing that much. We're only sending this little bit they need. Now, we also need to have process three send its data to process two and four, because they also need the cells in the border. So process three is also going to send messages. So a way you might implement this is you might say, all the even processes send messages first to all the odd ones, which are their neighbors, and then all the odd ones send messages to all the even ones. And when someone's sending, you're receiving, and that's a way of doing our game of life with just sending two sets of messages every iteration. Okay. Questions on this approach? Just send messages. First, we send messages to all the odd processes and then to all the even processes. And it's just to get this little piece of overlap that they need. Okay. So we're not going to do detail on how to use one of these message processing APIs, but I want you to be aware of it, because sometimes threads just aren't the right tool for your problem. And aren't the most convenient tool. So any questions about message passing or alternatives to threads in general? Because my next topic has very little to do with threads. Okay, so our next topic in this class is going to be virtual memory. Now, virtual memory is kind of an awkward topic. So in CS3 through 30 and COA 2, virtual memory is covered for several days of class time. For CPEs, the prereq for this class is the embedded class, and not the architecture class, which is what you'd expect because I just said 3330 and COA 2, they're both architecture classes. The prereq in CPE is not architecture, which I've gotten confused about, because of course it would be architecture. Why wouldn't it be the same? But no, that prereq that's in the catalog is the embedded, and I've been confused, and sometimes I assume people know things that they don't. And this is a virtual memory is a place where this really comes up, because I gather even in the CPE architecture class, it's covered lots less detail than we typically do in 3330 or COA 2. So some of you are going to be at different spots in this topic, and I'm going to do a review of things, which are hopefully a review for people who've taken 3330 or COA 2, I understand from my past experience that some people who've taken 30 through 30 don't seem to have remembered any part of that part of the course, so it's probably helpful anyways. But there's a difference, and please do stop me if I'm like rushing way, way far ahead, because it might just be because you don't have the same prereq everyone else has, even though because we're not synchronized in that way. Okay, so with the prereq note out of the way. So virtual memory is about address translation. We mentioned address translation earlier. The idea is we have multiple programs on our system. We want them to access pointers, and we don't want them to interfere with each other. In fact, we want them to both think that they own the whole memory. And address translation is our mechanism for this, that the operating system sets a mapping so that some addresses that program A uses map to its code and its data, and the same for program B. And because the OS sets this mapping, it can in fact have the same address in both programs can be different things. So both program A and program B might use addresses that are like, you know, might say my main is at 0x4000, and that might go to its code, and program B can use that same address, and that would go to its code, even though those are different parts of the real memory. This also means that there's no way for, say, program A to get to program B's code. It just can't do it. So it provides this sort of protection that two programs can't interfere with each other, in addition to being able to use the same address for different things if they want. And virtual memory is the form that this address translation takes in almost all modern processors. So that's what we're going to talk about, and we're going to talk a lot about it. And we're going to first talk about sort of what virtual memory is, sort of what the hardware mechanism is. And we're also going to spend a lot of time talking about sort of tricks the operating system can do using virtual memory to add basically features to the memory that aren't in the like real hardware. And we'll talk about what those are a bunch later, but that's why we're talking about it. There's a lot of things the operating system is going to do to make our memory more powerful than it really natively is by taking advantage of having this mapping and being able to manipulate this mapping. So let's talk about setting up this address translation. And to do that, I need to talk about, well, let's have a memory layout. So here's a memory layout for a program on a very simple processor, which has 10-bit addresses for programs. So there's only so many memory locations. This is really small. And we're saying that I've divided up my program's memory into quarters. I'm saying that we have a stack, we have data and the heap, we have some code, and we have some empty region, or maybe we'll put more heap here. And I'm just going to take these divisions, and I'm going to call these chunks of memory pages. And I'm going to call them virtual pages, because virtual is going to be our term for things the program knows about. And they're virtual because what the program knows about over here aren't the real things. They're the simulation. So I'm just going to call them virtual pages. And I'm going to actually choose the size of these chunks very carefully. So I'm choosing 2 to the 8 bytes. And the reason I'm choosing 2 to the 8 bytes is because that's a power of 2. I can look at this numbering here, 0, 1, 2, 3. And I can read that out from my addresses, from the top bits. I just drop the last 8 bits. Why 8? Because it's 2 to the 8 bytes per page. So there's 2 to 8 bits to ignore to determine where in the page we are. The rest tells us which of the virtual pages we are with this exact number. And this is going to be really useful because the hardware and the operating system are often going to need to take an address and say, which of these chunks is it? Because this is what we're going to manipulate. I'm going to call the rest of the address the page offset. That name page offset comes from that part of the address tells us where in the page we are. It's, if we take the address and take it modulo the page size, this is exactly what we get. So this is just what, where in the page are we? Are we at the beginning? Are we at the end? So we call it the page offset. So questions so far? Okay. So I've divided up my memory into these pages, and I have some real memory. And for this example, we're going to say my real memory is bigger than the memory programs can use. This doesn't have to be the case. It could be smaller. This example, we're just making it bigger. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to divide up my real memory, which I'll call my physical memory, which physical addresses, into pages of the exact same size. And I'll choose a correspondence between the virtual pages, the ones the program knows about, and the physical pages that takes each virtual page and maps it to at most one physical page. So in this case, I've mapped page 0 to here, virtual page 1 to here, virtual page 3 to here, and virtual page 2, I just haven't set anything. And this is the type of decision I'm going to make for the address translation. This is the form my table is going to take, is deciding on what lines I draw. Right, translation function. And of course, we need to actually represent this translation function in some way the hardware can understand. So I'm just going to write it out as a table. So there's my table. I have an entry in the table for every virtual page number, and I have the physical page number as what's in the table. And we'll call this a page table. So questions about this here? Okay. So this is the type of structure that the operating system is going to provide to the hardware, and the hardware is going to use to do what we know as address translation. So here's our table, and I've represented it in a form that's closer to what it would be in hardware. So here we have a valid bit, and we need a valid bit because I had this none entry. And you could say, well, couldn't I just put all zeros for null? Well, no, because that's an actual physical page. Like that would be, if I put all zeros, I would be drawing this line, and that would be a valid thing to do, but probably not what I wanted. And I can't put all ones, that's also valid, so I have to have a separate bit to tell me is it valid or not. And I also have the actual number. And the hardware is going to get an address from the program. And it's going to divide it up into the virtual page number and the page offset. And it's going to take the virtual page number and go to that row of this table and pull out the values. And it's going to pull out the physical page number from here and use it to replace the virtual page number in the address. We're just going to copy the page offset through, because if the virtual address is at the beginning of a virtual page, we want to get a value near the beginning of the physical page. So we're just going to copy the page offset part of the address, do that. Now, we also need to take care of this valid bit, because if I access some memory which doesn't have a mapping, we want to trigger an exception. And this is the exception you may know for turning into a segmentation fault, one of them. That's the sort of exception we want to trigger, rather than moving on with the program. Even though we do have, I wrote question marks here, but there's something there, but we're not going to use it. Yes?
So it'll only trigger the exception, like zero basically means
yeah, zero means, the question is, zero means it's not mapped to anything at all? Yes. And we don't care there's some bits there because this is like going to be stored in like a register or memory, but we don't care what they are. So we call each row of this table a page table entry. So we're going to look up a page table entry, pull out its valid bit and its physical page number. And we look up the page table entry using what we call the virtual page number to get a physical page number, which we use to form the actual address we send onto the hardware. Now here I have it going to the cache. Typically, this translation happens before our caches, both for instruction and data cache. And we have a page offset, which is just copied as is. And this is the big, big win from choosing our page sizes to be a power of 2, so that we can just copy that versus having the hardware do some like multiplication or division every time we access memory, including for like reading instructions, which would be really expensive. Okay, so questions? Other questions about this picture? Okay, so in that case, have exercise. So on 32-bit x86, the typical page size is 4,096 bytes, or 2 to the 12 bytes. So if we have this virtual address, what is the virtual page number and what's the page offset? And let's say I look up its page table entry and I find out the physical page number is hex 998, what's the physical address we're going to use for that address? I'll give you a minute. You can check with your neighbor. Was that part of the page number?
I don't remember.
No, it's not.
No, it's not part of the page number.
Time still? Some people? Okay. A little more time.
Well, it developed in
20. No, but you need one bit from the back.
Yeah, so it would probably just be the
bit. So page offset would be minus.
Okay, so anyone want to volunteer a strategy for starting to solve this? Apparently not. Okay, so I will go. So what we want to the first thing that would be useful to figure out is here, I like marked up how the address is split up into the virtual page number and the page offset. And we remember that that's just a fixed split, right? So we want to figure out what are the sizes for this. And we have 2 to the 12 byte pages, which means that we're going to have 12 bits in our address that determine the page offset, because we need 12 bits to know where in the page are we. That means all the other bits of the address are going to be our virtual page number. And we could convert that hexadecimal address to binary, and then peripherally find 12 bits. I will use the trick that every hexadecimal digit is 4 bits. So the least significant 4 bits here, or least significant 12 bits, are these 3 digits, and this is the page offset. And that means everything else is our virtual page number. So our virtual page number is ABCD0 in hex, and our page offset is 0x123 in hex. Yes? So the question is, why is there a valid bit? Isn't there a valid bit? So our valid bit was not part of our address, because it's in the page table. And in the page table, we had a separate valid bit and physical page number. Because the valid bit was only to tell us whether it was worth looking at the physical page number. So the valid bit doesn't come in here. And in our next part, I tell you it maps to that physical page. To know that, I must have looked at the page table and determined the valid bit was set to 1. And that's where the valid bit would have come in this translation, is that I knew it was set to 1 when I looked to figure out that it maps to physical page hex 998. So since we know that this is the physical page number, I can use that to replace the VPN in my address. So I get 0x998 followed by my page offset. Any questions about how we did this? Yeah.
Quick question about the slide before.
Yeah.
So why do we have the valid and invalid bits if the invalid has no mapping to the physical memory addresses?
So the question is, why do we have the invalid bits? So it's going to turn out when we have a real program, we often have lots of memory that isn't valid to access. And we want some way of representing that. So a common example in your programs is like the space between the stack and the heap on your program. Like there's all this unallocated memory. We want to represent that in the mapping somehow, and that's how we're going to do it. Other questions? Okay, so we think about this exercise. We saw we have these really big virtual page numbers. And you might think, so what does the structure of the 32-bit x86 page table look like? And based on what I showed you before, you'd say, oh, it should look something like this. We have rows for every possible virtual page number for 32-bit addresses, from 00000 hex to FFFFF hex. And each of those contains a valid bit and a physical page number. And we're also going to have some other information. So these are going to be known as permissions. So we're going to keep track. We're going to let you do other things about whether the access is OK. So whether you can read or write might be examples. We might have some other permissions bits, like kernel only is another example, executable. But we'll have other metadata bits besides the valid bit about how you can use this memory, which the processor will check when you do an access. But the lookup is the same. We just are also going to check these permission bits based on the type of access. And it seems like a perfectly reasonable strategy. So questions about permissions bits before we move on? Yeah.
So in this case, did you just add the two permission bits to 7, 8, 8, or 9?
So the question is, would I just add the two permission bits? No. The permission bits are going to be used similar to the valid bit. We're going to sometimes trigger an exception, depending on the type of access. So it's like we check the valid bit, we're also going to check these permission bits, depending on whether we're reading or writing. Okay. Other questions? Now, there's a big problem with this from a practical point. Yes?
So why is it 78851, but we're trying to get
78851? Oh, because I can't copy addresses from my table. Sorry, it should be the actual row I have highlighted and not the one from the row after it. Yeah. Sorry. Okay. So there's a problem with this scheme, which is a little subtle, and that's that this table is really big. It has 2 to the 20 entries. And with this metadata, the actual size of these entries is about 4 bytes. So one question is, where can we store that much stuff? Like, with our previous example, you might get the idea, oh, this is just like a little special thing inside the processor. When we're looking at 2 to the 20 entries, like 4 megabytes of stuff, that becomes harder. And also, this is, you know, this is a lot of overhead for every process. And this is with 32 bits. And you know we have 64-bit systems. So with 64 bits, that seems like completely unmanageable. So it turns out we're not going to store the structure like this. We're going to use something more complicated. And we're also not going to store it in the place you might expect. We're going to store it in memory. So we're going to keep it in memory. But of course, you might say memory's slow. Well, it is. So we're also going to have a special cache, like a dedicated cache only for page tables to handle it being in memory and that being slow. That special cache is called a translation look-aside buffer, or TLB. And because it's so big, we're going to have a way of storing it more compactly. And this is another case where having non-valid entries is going to come in handy. And we're going to use a tree and only store the valid entries and not store mostly valid entries, and we're not going to store most of the invalid entries by using a tree. And the way we're going to do this is we're going to take advantage of the fact that we have these large regions which are all invalid pages. So for example, the space between your stack and your heap on a typical process, you have like gigabytes of invalid memory. And we'd rather just store one tree node to indicate that rather than a page table entry for each 4K of that. And we also have like high memory, like above your program's memory, there's stuff that no one can access. We don't want to store that as all invalid. We just want to say all these are invalid in a more compact way. So we're going to have this tree structure. It's not going to be like the tree structures you learned in 2150 in that it's going to be a very bushy tree. We're going to have a lot of things in each node. And in fact, we're only going to have on 32-bit x86, we're going to have two levels to this tree. So we're going to have what we'll call the first level page table, which is going to be our top level, which is going to point to second level page tables, which actually contain the page table entries I showed you before. And the idea is the first level page table contains entries for the range that each of those second level tables would cover. And rather than containing the physical address at which the program wants to get data, they contain the physical address of the page table, of the second level page table. So they just contain a pointer to the next level. At the last level, we have where is the program's data actually, assuming we got this far. And each of these on 32-bit x86 has 2 to the 10 entries. So they're actually 4 kilobytes in size, which, not coincidentally, is the same size as a page. And we're saving space because if we have a whole bunch of invalid entries, for example, let's say virtual page numbers 400 through BFF are all invalid, then we're just going to mark them as invalid in the first level. And when we do the lookup, we're not even going to bother finding a second level table. We're just going to say, they're invalid, we're done. And by doing this, we save a lot of space. We don't store all those page table entries for each of those individual virtual page numbers. We just store 2 page table entries to represent that whole range. And just say, it's all not valid. Don't look. There's nothing there. Trigger an exception if the program tries to use it. It's not good. So in our first level table, we're going to have the same sort of structure. We'll have our valid bits. We'll have our permission bits. And we'll have a physical page number. But rather than being the physical page number that the program wants to access, it's the physical page number of the next page table. And the processor is going to check the valid bits and also the permission bits before it looks on, goes on to the next page table. So if we don't have a next page table, we set the valid bit as 0, and we just get an error if the program tries to use that, an exception. And similarly, if we want to mark a whole region as not writable, we could set it here if we wanted. Okay. So we have these pointers to the next page tables. These pointers are represented using page numbers, though, not byte numbers, which sometimes confuses people. And our second level tables look exactly the same as the tables I showed you before, except that we only store a portion of the table, so they start somewhere in the middle based on where we found a pointer to them. And I'll have more detail on like what these actually look like as they're laid out in memory, but so, because I'm just giving you sort of like how they're decoded, I'll show you that in a bit. So questions on how this structure works? And so I showed you that this first level page table we have, since the first level page table is stored in memory, we're in fact going to have, we need to have a pointer to that. So this is actually what we're going to set with our processor when we tell it to run a program, is that we're going to set what's known as a page table base register. And we're going to make that point to the beginning of this first level table. And that's the information we're going to give our processor. So in fact, all these page tables are going to be stored in memory. They're just going to be arrays in memory. And the only thing that's special stored in the processor is that page table base register, which is going to be a special instruction to set. And And on x86, the page table based register has the most non-intuitive name, like, oh, well, not ever, but pretty close, of CR3, for control register 3. Sure, no one was expecting. Questions on this picture? Okay. So, a small note on naming. You might see multiple names for the different tables at different levels. So the thing the page table based register points to, you might call a first level page table, a top level page table, you might see it called. And there's also the term page directory. This is the term Intel uses, and this is also the term you'll see a bunch in the XV6 code. The second level page table, what the first level page table entries point to, I will try to call the second level page table. Intel just calls it page table because they call the other thing a page directory. This is not what other people do, just everyone has their own terms. And XV6 sometimes uses Intel's terminology, which is very confusing. I'm going to try to disambiguate and use first and second level page table, but when you're reading the XV6 source code, you're going to see page directory. That means a first level page table. And if you see an unadorned page table, they probably mean a second level page table. So, talked about sort of the high level structure. And we have to think about how do we actually use this. So the way it's going to work is we have these 4-byte page table entries. And the two-level table, the way we're going to use that is we're going to take our virtual address. We're going to split off the page offset, which is the last 12 bits. We're going to use the first 10 bits of the address to look it up in the first level, and the second 10 bits to look it up in the second level that we find using that first level. And this happens to correspond to these ranges of virtual page numbers you saw here, because everything in that first entry has 0 for the first 10 bits, everything has 1 for the first 10 bits for the second entry, and so on. So we can think of the address being divided like this. This is from, you can see that picture, this is from the XV6 source code's comments. And because XV6 needs to deal with addresses being split up this way, they have some utility macros. So they have this PDX, which extracts what they call the page directory index, the top 10 bits of an address, which tells you which array entry in the first level page table is it. They have this PTX, they call page table index, which tells you which array entry in a second level page table is it. And they also have something to construct an address if you know the indexes in both. So from this, you can view the page table lookup in this sort of way, where we have our page table base register, which points to the first level page table. We take the first part of the virtual page number, use that to find the index in this table, and use the second part to find index in the second table we find using that first page table entry. And then we get our actual physical page and find our program's data. So let's do a little exercise. So we talked about these two-level tables. So let's say I have this virtual address, and my page table base pointer has the byte address. So that's not a page number, that's the byte address. So it has a page offset and a page number in it. And it's a physical address, because we can't use a page table to look up where our page tables are. That would not work out. Is 1,000. And I've told you, when you do the lookup, these are the physical page numbers you get. So first question is, what is the address of our first level page table entry? So where am I going to find that table entry? And our page table entries are 4 bytes, which is important to know because it's an array. So an array means that we store 4 bytes for the first entry, followed by 4 bytes for the next array element, and so on. I'll give you a minute. Who would like more time? Couple people, okay. So for solving this problem, our first step is going to be to find what are the indexes in each of the tables. And we're told that the first 10 bits of our 32-bit address are going to be the lookup in the first level. So that is here. Here's our first 10 bits, because this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, just written out in binary. So our first 10 bits is this number, which turns out to be, in hexadecimal, we have an 8 at the bottom, followed by a 4 and then a 0. So we have VPN part 1 is 0x48. And that's the index into the array, but array elements are 4 bytes. So we're going to go 0x48 times 4 elements into the array. Bytes into the array, and that's going to be our address. So it's going to be, the address is going to be our base address plus 0x48 times 4. And that's going to be where we're going to look for our page table entry, which is going to be some 4 bytes, which is going to encode our physical page number and the valid bit and all that other information. For our second level, we know that for our first level physical page number starts at 0x14, which means that this is the physical page number, which means that its base address is 0x14000 as a byte address, because I need a page offset of 0. That's the beginning of that page. So this is the first byte of page. So we're going to take that, and we're going to add whatever the index in the table is times 4, because each table entry is 4 bytes. And our index here is 0x345, if we look at this binary encoded to that in hex. So it's plus 0x345 times 4 bytes per entry. So questions on what I did here? Yes. Because, so the question is, why did I add the zeros for the 14? This is a physical page number and not a byte address. So I only know what page it is, but I'm giving an address that's a particular byte where the page table entry is, because knowing the page it's in doesn't help me. Does that answer your question? Maybe? question is, why do I multiply by 4? I multiply by 4 because I'm told page table entries are 4 bytes. So we can't store a physical page number in 1 byte because they're bigger than that. Right? We saw that they're, you know, they don't all fit in 1 byte. They're often pretty big. So we need more space for that. And we've happened to choose 4 bytes. On x86, they choose 4 bytes for 32-bit, typically, just to make things a power of 2. Other questions? And the reason I gave you these this address here as a physical page number is because that's what we store in our page table entries. We store physical page numbers, not particular bytes, because you can only refer to a whole page, not just parts of a page. Other questions? Question is, how do I know how many zeros to add? Because we have 2 to the 12 byte pages, I added 12 bits of zeros to indicate, because that's how much information I need to know, where in the page are we. I just added on a page offset. Other questions? So another exercise. So same setup. How big are page tables? So let's say I have a process which has exactly 1 valid 4-kilobyte page. How much space is used up by its page tables? By having 1 valid 4-kilobyte page, I mean if I'm running in the program, there's 1 page I can access and not get an exception from no valid bits being wrong. And assume we're doing the most compact thing possible. And also, once you figure that out, let's say all the pages are valid. I can access everything and get something. How big do we expect the page tables to be? Who would like more time? So, anyone want more time? No one's volunteering. Okay. But probably. Okay, so I'll start with the first question. So if we have 1 valid page that we can access, in order for that to happen, we need to go into our first level page table, which has to exist, or else we can't have any valid pages, definitely. And we need to have a valid entry in there. And that valid entry needs to point to a second level table, which also has a valid entry. So we have 2 valid entries, but to store those 2 valid entries, we need to have the whole table around them with invalid entries. So we need to have a whole first table to find all those not valid bits or 0 for all the other addresses. So I needed 1 table at the first level, and at the second level, I need to point to a whole table, even though only 1 entry in it was valid again. So I have 1 table at the second level, and each of these tables has 2 to the 10 entries and takes up 4 bytes. So this is going to be a total of 2 to the 12 times 2 bytes, or 8K. So how about if we have all the pages available? So then we have our first level where we have 2 to the 10 valid pointers, each of which goes to another table, which has all valid pointers. So in that case, we have 2 to the 10 second level. So we have 2 to the 12 bytes for the first level plus 2 to the 10 times 2 to the 12 bytes for the second level. For 1 plus 2 to the 10 times 2 to the 12 bytes. The quantity 1 plus 2 to the 10. So another way of looking at it is we needed all the space we would need for the flat table. So we had 2 to the 20 pages with 4 bytes per each page, plus the first level table to point to those pieces of the flat table. So questions? Yeah?
I understand the 2 to the 12 for the first level.
Yeah.
But for the first question, I don't understand why it's multiplied only by 2.
So it's multiplied by 2 because in our first level, we're going to have everything marked as invalid except for one entry. And that means we need another entry at the second, and that one entry which is valid needs to point to another page table at the second level. And that takes up the other 2 to the 12 bytes. Even though only one entry is valid in it, we still need the whole table at the second level. We can't save space. So now we have maybe a slightly better idea of how this works. And again, this should be review for people who've taken 3030 and COA2, but my experience is maybe not so much. So let's talk about how this applies to XV6. So XV6 has this mapping between virtual and physical. So virtual memory is divided into two pieces. There's this part in blue, which is for the kernel only. And in fact, it's marked with the permission bits in the page table, so user programs, if they try to access it, they get the equivalent of a segfault. And we have this bottom part in green, which is for user programs. And the separation mark is halfway in between, which has the special constant kernbase in the XV6 source code. And the page tables for the blue part are actually set up in a very simple way, that they're just a one-to-one mapping to physical addresses. So kernbase plus 0 is physical address 0. Kernbase plus 1,000 is physical address 1,000, and so on. And that's just because that's how XV6 initializes the page tables, just tediously set up all those mappings. The addresses in the green area, well, it depends on what your program is using. So there's some mapping, and typically, most addresses programs are using have two valid virtual addresses, one in the user part of memory and one in the kernel part of memory. Which is just done by setting two different page table entries in second level page tables to point to the same page number. And this is exactly the mapping that's stored in our page tables, collectively, for each process. Questions on this mapping? Sort of why we have two virtual addresses for a bunch of addresses, a bunch of physical addresses? Okay. So let's look in more detail at the program part of the memory. So this is the part that was previously in green. So the layout that XV6 has chosen is that we have the code, we have the global variables for a program, then we have what we call a guard page. I'll talk about that in a bit. Then we have the stack. And the stack on X36 is always one page. That's what page size is, so 4 kilobytes. If you need more than that, well, too bad. You don't got it. And the stack pointer starts at the top. And following that, we have the heap. This is a little different than what you're used to from something like Linux, where the stack starts above the heap. They just chose not to do that. And the heap has some end. And after the heap is in valid memory, if you allocate more memory, it extends the heap. Okay, so the guard page, this is a page after stack, and it's below the stack because the stack grows towards lower addresses. And the idea is that this is going to be marked as kernel mode only. So if you try to access it in user mode, you get an exception. And hopefully, this means when you have a stack overflow, that your program gets killed rather than something else happening, like your program trying to execute code from the stack or something. Like when you run out of stack space. This is a very common thing you see in real OSs. It's a nice idea. It's not 100% reliable. So for example, here I have a function which uses a whole lot of space on the stack, where I allocate a 2,000 element array and assign to the first thing in the array. And the way my 32-bit x86 compiler implemented this is subtract a whole bunch from the stack pointer, then use a value after I subtracted to get to the beginning of the array. So that could just skip over the entire guard page. So they're not 100% reliable, but it's sort of a heuristic way to usually catch this problem of running out of stack space. Okay, that's what that is. So talk about the layout. Now we're going to talk about what does the code in XV6 look like for this. So one thing that we need to do is we need to manipulate addresses a bunch. So in XV6, we're going to do that with this convention of using pointers for virtual addresses and integers for physical addresses. It's just a convention, but this is what they use in the source code to not get confused on whether I have a physical address or a virtual address. There are two utility functions related to this, or macros actually. So V2B converts a kernel virtual address to a physical address. It does this by subtracting kernbase. It subtracts that middle point of memory from it. This means if you supply it a user address, it won't work. It also won't give you an error message. It just will do the wrong thing. But because the kernel has that, you know, address 800000000 and so on mapping for kernel addresses, it just does the subtraction. It's really simple. And PTV does the opposite of that. Adds the base address for that kernel, that blue region of memory I showed you earlier, to give you a virtual address for a particular physical address. Okay. So we have addresses. Another thing we need to do is we need to actually have types for not just manipulating addresses, but for manipulating page tables. And since 32-bit x86 has 4-byte page table entries, we have two types for those, which are both just aliases for unsigned int. They're just another names for unsigned int. So there's one called PDET, which is for a first-level page table entry, stands for page directory entry. And one called PTET, which is for a second-level page table entry. These are both just other names for unsigned int, but the XV6 source code uses PDET_T, and so on, to indicate we're working with a page table here, not just a normal integer. And the page tables are just arrays of, I have the wrong number here, of 1,024 entries. They're a 1,024-byte array. They're 4,096-byte arrays of 1,024 entries. So you might say, well, if the page table entries are integers, how does the valid bit and so on get represented in that? And here I have the documentation from Intel for the format of the page table entries and everything else. So this is just a figure from the Intel documentation. At the top of it is the format of the page table base register. So the page table base register has the page number of the page directory, and some other stuff, you will always leave it 0. So in fact, it contains the byte address of the first level page table. And this is what we supply to the processor via a special instruction. Then we have stuff in memory. We have first level page table entries. And there are three different formats here. XV6 only uses the last two. So we have the format where we have a zero here, and that represents invalid. So if it's invalid, we have bit zero, the least significant bit of the integer, set to zero, and everything else is ignored by the processor, so it doesn't matter what you put there as far as the processor is concerned. If it's one, it's valid, and we have the address of the page table, which is the physical page number. So this is the physical page number of the second level. This is the valid bit here. And we also have a bunch of permission bits over here, the most notable of which is it writable, and can it be accessed? Can it be accessed in user mode? So that's our first level page table entries. Then we have our second level page table entries, where we have our physical page number again, and also the same permission bits over here, and some other bits we won't use. And again, we have a valid bit and the least significant bit. So if it's one, the processor looks for a page number. If it's zero, the whole thing's invalid. It doesn't care what you put there. So questions on this? The XV6 source code just constructs integers that match this bit pattern to produce its page table entries. Now, something that's really convenient and very deliberate is that you can take a physical page number concatenated with zeros in size equal to the page offset, and you can get it lines up. So here I have, if I have a physical address, these zeros are would be my page offset part, and this would be my physical page number, and it lines up exactly with how the page table entries work. So if I just take the physical address of the first byte of a page that has the right high bits, and I just need to set the lower bits. So what I typically do to construct a page table entry is I take the physical address of the first byte of the page, of the physical page, and OR together to add in the flag bits, the things like, is it writable, is it valid, and so on. And that's a deliberate design to make it much easier to make page table entries. I don't need to shift things around to get the page number in the right place. I just take the byte address at the beginning of the page and OR it with all the permissions I want to set on the page. Do I want it to be readable, and so on. Okay. And based on this, so we'll talk about this next time, but we'll just finish up with, so I showed you the page table entry format. XV6, not surprisingly, has constants defined for all the things in there, including all the bits you might set. The present or valid bits, and all the other permission bits, some of which XV6 doesn't use, but they have constants for. And we'll pick up on this next time.